is Jason Horsey, and this is The Last Liminalist, the podcast between of 2019. This week I'm talking to Piers, a reader and listener, about Prisoner of Infinity, which is a book I published in 2018 about UFOs, social engineering, and the psychology of fragmentation. I was thinking, you mentioned that you were going to write more, and then we agreed to do this. So I was kind of hoping that you had taken notes, or that at least you had some sense of what else you wanted to give me feedback-wise about Prisoner of Infinity, and maybe we can start there.
Well, I mean, it really is kind of a stunning book for a reader like myself. Having, you know, spent a lot of time with, you know, everything from Aleister Crowley to psychedelics to, you know, so on, Peter Lavenda. Mm-hmm. And then there being these things that just didn't quite sit right. Like I can recall with the Lavenda interview some time ago, I think it was on, what was that podcast? Higher Side Chats. I don't know if you listened to that.
No, I didn't. But,
what's his name? I can't remember the guy, but he brought up the fact, he brought up something about Michael Aquino. Mm-hmm. And Lavenda just was really strident in his defense of Aquino.
Wow.
And basically saying that anyone who ever attacked him was full of it.
Wow. Huh.
Other things were like, reading about, I never really got into Whitley Strieber quite like you did, but I did read the book, the Kripal book, and the thing about Strieber that always got me was his relationship with the Gurdjieff work.
Mm-hmm.
And are you well acquainted with that?
No, not hardly at all, really. I haven't even read Gurdjieff book or the Uspensky, or just that it, you know, I keep picking up bits and pieces over the years because it's so ubiquitous.
Well, Gurdjieff's magnum opus happens on a spaceship. So the book's written in 1947. Mm-hmm. And Gurdjieff's writing this vast allegory that occurs on a spaceship.
In 1947, huh?
In 1947.
Wow.
And then that, you know, Strieber would be... I don't know. I just found it very, very odd. And it never comes up when Strieber never really talks very much about this. He talks a little bit about the body sensing exercise, but I don't really recall him making much, you know, getting very deep into it.
Go ahead.
And then the other thing that was just really jumped out at me was your whole meme on de-eroticization. And that's really what I was writing you about. Mm-hmm. Was I referenced this guy, Richard Walter, who talks about intimacy without vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically, you know, he's famous for doing crime scenes without any forensic evidence at all. He basically looks at the crime scene and he identifies the perp according to this classification scheme that he came up with.
Mm-hmm.
So he's something of a legend in those circles. And he sees the intimacy without vulnerability moving on this path from pornography all the way down to cannibalism, which would ultimately be, you know, the ultimate in intimacy without vulnerability.
Right.
And then when I relate that to my work and the concept of de-eroticization, is I see all these young men who've gotten millennials who've gotten very deeply into digital pornography and speed stimulant medication, Adderall, or crystal meth. Mm-hmm. And the effects of those drugs are to make your emotions really shallow. So nothing really particularly bothers you. Right. But at the same time, you're on this dopamine rush, and it has this kind of aphrodisiac quality to it, which makes for, you know, these young men to be really, really lost deep in these pornographic sinkholes and having almost no way to connect emotionally to the other. Hmm. And so when I look at, you know, this larger programming thing that your work points to, it would seem that the combination of the digital with the overprescription of these medications, which happens more in boys than women, mm-hmm. is sort of kind of creating this different, it's very Ahrimanic kind of pathology.
Like a mutant strain.
Yeah, like the human being is it's like a loss of social intelligence and a loss of a sense of eros in all of it, really.
So tell me a little bit about your work, because you only mentioned it in passing. So you've been working for decades with drug addicts.
Yeah, I was a drug addict myself, and I had some pretty strong, profound experiences with recovery, which really led me down a long path that always had these questions that came up. And one of the big ones was, why does psychiatry dominate this field when they have almost nothing to show for it? Mm. So the medical, you know, by calling addiction a disease incessantly, you leave people with the impression that it should be amenable to you know, to a medical treatment. Mm-hmm. And it isn't, and it never has been.
Right.
And in fact, you know, they've done everything from comas to the frontal lobotomy.
Yeah. Electroshock.
Right. Mm. And then the other thing that happened was I later became acquainted with Native American recovery folks, and I did a training with them. I was the only white person there, and they told me something that really shocked me. They said, in intact indigenous cultures, there is no addiction. And I was quite taken aback by that, and I later, you know, looked into it, and it's actually true. So addiction really is, you know, really starts in England. Modern addiction, mm-hmm. alcoholism, the gin craze right around the Enclosure Acts.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see this, you see that this sort of severance with the relationship with the earth accompanying the advent of addiction,
mm.
sort of this certain trauma that's at the root of it. And then almost no one ever wants to talk about that, which I say is very much related to your whole meme about disembodiment. So, you know, reading your work just made all kinds of things go off in my head. Although the most challenging thing about it was Craig Hall, because I've been a fan for some time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. And I was not making the connection you were making, which is that, I could see that he was making a strong point that trauma and spirituality, you know, there can be a relation to certain kinds of spiritual, paranormal experiences. But I couldn't see that he was doing that in a very, to the exclusion of other ways, mm. and that it fits so nicely with this sort of Gnostic spaceship, discarnate, out-of-body experience. I wasn't putting all that together.
So what was it that made you a fan of Kripal then?
Oh, I love things like in Authors of the Impossible. I thought that was quite interesting that people were writing even as they were being written. Mm-hmm. I liked the meme of in the absence of the religious, we have the psychic. But then when you pointed out how curiously anti-psychological it is, or maybe not anti, unpsychological it is, that was shocking to me too, that I hadn't seen that. So I would imagine this journey has been really, I can't imagine what it's been like for you, because your audience must have just flipped.
You mean flipped as in flipped out, or as in turned to a different perspective?
Or turned to an entirely different audience.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure, because of course an audience is a theory, really, unless they're all in the same room at the same time. I can't get a sense of them except as individuals, and even then, even when they're in the same room, it's still a collective of individuals. I mean, I know that, yeah, there are people who've contacted me who have felt that they were on a similar sort of arc of discovery and disillusionment. I think discovery, disillusionment, they're almost synonymous in my life anyway. I guess it makes sense. You get to discover the truth, you need to get past the illusions. And so specifically with occultism, I mean, that would be the widest umbrella to put it under in terms of what I've progressively discovered the flaws in. It wouldn't be quite accurate to just call it occultism, but it's probably the closest descriptor I can think of. There's definitely a lot of people who have been drawn to me who have also been drawn to occultism and various different proponents of it. Of course, there's an overlap, as Lavender very much exemplifies, between conspiracy theory and occultism, whether it's because researching deep state parapolitical machinations leads to the discoveries about occult ideologies and occult methodologies and occult groups, or whether because it leads to an interest in occultism, or the other way around, that somebody who's into occultism begins to get more of a sense of this hidden side of society. But anyway, they overlap so much that it's hard to separate them. And even in the meaning of the word, as in hidden, what is hidden isn't necessarily paranormal or esoteric or mystical at all. It might actually be very mundane and profane, but because it's concealed, it has this mystery about it. So I would say that there are people who've found my work helpful and useful in terms of the penny dropping, like you're suggesting. But I think there's as many, if not more, people who the penny was already dropping, and they were either already following along with me and it coincided, or they found me at that point.
Well, it's rather striking that a lot of the people who make it their business to write about the occult, the Davises and Kripal and company, how they are allergic to the parapolitical.
Seems like it somewhat, yeah.
And what do you owe that to? Is it professionally scandalous for them to go there, or?
I guess that's I'm working on a book currently about Hollywood, and even thinking about approaching agents and just thinking about how to reach a larger audience, because the subject is more relevant to more people than Whitley Strieber. You're talking about Hollywood, where almost everybody's impacted by Hollywood and movie culture and TV, so it's obviously a much wider subject matter, so it makes sense that the book could reach more people and be helpful to more people. So why not pursue that? And I'm aware of very much this, what you just said, that in today's climate, it would be very easy to get pigeonholed in the mind of a reader, an agent or a publisher, as a right wing something or other. I'm not even sure, you know. I mean, I don't even like using the terms or the categories that I suspect these people refer to, because they're so meaningless to me. But that's kind of the point, that people do have these compartments and these categories, and they do have these associations. And yeah, looking at the deep parapolitical, it's very ironic and paradoxical, because Marxism is all about that to some degree. It's not about conspiracy theory, but conspiracy theory itself is a misnomer that has kind of created the reality that it named in some way. As in, you're not necessarily positing a global conspiracy, let's say, if you're looking at long-term deep state social engineering. It's just that it really looks like a conspiracy theory that, you know, is of that kind, right? So yeah, there's a danger of getting tainted by association if you talk about certain things. And I think that that would be a superficial explanation for why somebody like Eric Davis stays away from it. I mean, Eric and I have talked about this, and but we haven't reached a satisfying conclusion. And
I detected a real resistance on his part to actually talk content.
Yeah.
And he was just talking conspiracy theory per se.
That's right. So it's almost, as I've written in this current book and blog post that led up to it, it's almost a philosophical position that some of these people take, as if, no, this isn't the right frame through which to view the world, because, one of the reasons they give, I know Kripal also, I mean, they have different exact ways of framing it, but is that, you know, conspiracy reduces it too much to nuts and bolts and human agency and all the rest of it, and there's something much deeper going on here. And I don't disagree with that at all. But, I mean, Kripal himself is on record as saying he doesn't do conspiracy theory, and he doesn't mean that's not my field. He means he doesn't go there, he doesn't believe it has any validity. That's right. How he means it.
Does he really?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for him, but if you listen to the times he said it in the context, that's what he's saying. Like when he's asked, what about Esalen and the suggestion that Esalen has been a front for the CIA and that has been complicit with programs of, psychic research and whatever. He'll say, I don't do conspiracy theory. Boom. Right? End of question. But he's the official biographer of Esalen. So the only justification for saying that in that way would have to be, I don't believe there's any validity in it. Because if he was just saying, well, that's not my area, but I'm the official biographer of Esalen, well, then he's obviously exposing his complete lack of seriousness or rigor as an academic, which I think, personally, I think is true. I don't think he's a very rigorous researcher or academic. I think he's very woolly-minded. But as with Lavender, it's very hard to tell when it's woolly-mindedness and when it's strategic, deliberate evasion. We'll be right back.
Right. I mean, there's part of me, perhaps I still have this fondness for Cry Paul that wants to, you know, it's easier for me to ascribe that to Lavenda.
Yeah.
What's funny is that we're at this moment, at least with a couple of books, I don't know if you saw them, the recent one on Sidney Gottlieb, America's Poisoner or something.
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it just came out. I read it. And it's basically a biography of Sidney Gottlieb and his role in MKUltra and all that. Mm. Got good reviews. It's sort of a fairly mainstream book. Mm-hmm. And then there was the other book, which I liked very much, which was Tom O'Neill on the Manson thing.
Yeah, I just read that. Yeah,
I thought that was fantastic.
I thought it was very good. I do have some qualifications, but we can get into them or not. But anyway, carry on.
Well, thanks. I love all things Manson. I just think it's interesting that we're at a time where MKUltra itself is not taboo
for a
mainstream publisher.
That's right.
And yet the religious studies folks can't touch it. And I thought it was very interesting your comment about, are you noting that Pasulka had said, what did she say? She said she had children or something to that effect.
Yeah, that's right. She had children and she had, you know, a position that she needed to maintain at the university.
Yeah, that's all very strange. I'm quite struck at my reluctance. I kept reading your book, so I couldn't have been too reluctant, but it really did hit me between the eyes.
With Kripal.
Kripal, Pasulka, even Davis. I mean, for me, they're a troika. I mean, the two of them studied with Kripal.
So okay.
Well,
that's okay. That's an interesting point. Because I don't write about Pasulka in Prisoner Infinity because I hadn't read it at that point, but then I did the blog post about it. I didn't talk to Eric about Pasulka, even though I wanted to. I think I sent him those essays. It's a very difficult area or subject to approach in terms of, I mean, accusing an academic of faulty research or faulty reporting is already pretty sensitive. Accusing them of actually, you know, lying is, you know, I mean, you just can't do it, really. I mean, there isn't really any point in doing it, because if you're right, they're just going to keep lying, and if you're wrong, well, you don't want to be saying that, right? So, but ignoring it completely, I mean, there's no point in having a conversation if you're going to completely ignore something.
Well, I think the irony of it is you may wind up being the one being completely ignored.
Well, yes, that's right. that's very true, and that's more or less the case with Prisoner Infinity. Not that it's been completely ignored, but it's been completely ignored by the people who are aligned with or propagating the narratives that it's challenging.
Do you know if Gordon White has any comment on your work or anything along those lines?
Are you a fan of Gordon White?
Well, I don't know anymore. Yeah. I've been following Gordon White for some time. I never read Starships. I listened to Rune Soup and such.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't listen to Gordon White. I invited him on the podcast couple of years ago or more, and he agreed, and then he stopped answering my emails, and that was it. So I wondered, you know, what had happened there. I had a guess at the time that he'd gone around my site a bit and found the Christopher Knowles thing, and that had annoyed him, because Christopher Knowles and I kind of had it out at one point. And Christopher Knowles is also a bit friendly with Kripal. You know who I mean, Secret Son?
I do. I've never really looked at his stuff at all, but I know who he is.
Well, he's done some really good work recently, over the years, really. I'd say better than any other sort of semi-mainstream researcher I can think of. Obviously not mainstream, but, you know, I mean, prominent alternate research that I can think of into the kind of stuff that I go into, the really deep, dark, deep state stuff. Around organized child abuse and MKUltra and Satanism in the culture, let's say. but and he's definitely very skeptical about Strieber, and he I don't know how he feels about Lavenda, but Lavenda publicly dissed me at his website in the comments section.
I did read that. Yes,
he kind of had to MC a bit that, and he and I had a brief exchange about that, and he is. Probably it might not want me saying this on the record, but he is very suspicious of Lavenda. I think just about anyone is now, unless they're diehard fans, because I think Lavenda's tipped his hand. But anyway, bring it back to Gordon White. It was a bit of a digression, wasn't it? It's just kind of giving a sense of the terrain now and how there's all these interpersonal relationships and dynamics in this kind of...
Well, I just wanted to hit the hornet's nest anyway. So.
Virtual community. No, it's good. So Gordon White, I mean, I don't know enough about him, but what I've looked at, he's full on proponent of the occult, whereas somebody mm-hmm. like Chris Knowles isn't. He's anti-occult, like he stays away from it, at least vocally. I mean, in terms of if he's representing his position honestly, then he stays away from it and he sees it all as really dodgy, I would say. And that to me is just common sense. If you looked into it enough, then you know that you can't disentangle the threads of occultism from the really dark, nasty stuff. Doesn't mean entirely that you can't. I don't know if anyone could practice it and not end up, you know, fucked up. I personally doubt it, but there are people like John Michael Greer that, who knows, you know, what kind of occultism they practice. They seem more or less reasonable. But what's his name? Gordon White. He advocates Crowley stuff. And
he does rather strongly, actually.
Strongly. So you don't really have to speculate too much to know that he simply wouldn't. And if you just look at the list of the guests that he has on and the people he talks to, there, you know, there's a number of them, or that maybe all of the characters that I've gone after. Well, he hasn't had Whitley on his show, but it is a fairly small community, and there's no doubt that I must have. You know, I've rocked the boat a bit, and I pissed off quite a few people, and probably had some sort of effect. I mean, certainly, as I say, more and more people are vocally aware that Peter Lavender is fishy, as you know, as a barrel of mackerel. And whether or not Lavender himself was letting that be seen, because I think he has been to some extent, I think there is this kind of coming out going on. I was definitely one of the first to really start pointing the things out, and he definitely didn't like it. So, you know, at the very least, I kind of forced it out a bit quicker than.
Well, I think your thesis, you know, around the mind control, around programming, you know, one of the things that it does is it brings a certain measure of coherence to a lot of very ambiguous phenomena. Just, you know, you can see that in the sort of field, you know, the occult world at large, but you especially can see it just in a Whitley Strieber. You know, all these contradictions, all these failures to remember one thing or another. Mm. And I think that is what might be challenging. I think people like their messy, everything goes mm-hmm. cultism. Everybody has their own little niche, their own little pet theory, their own little, and that the idea that these things can be, I don't know how to put it, weaponized? Is that too strong a word?
Well, it's a word that Lavender practically coined. I know he certainly uses it a hell of a lot, and now it's become very trendy. I think it's more subtle than that, isn't it? And what you're saying is that it brings coherence to something is very important to me. It's very meaningful, because that's central to my quest, is to make the world more coherent for myself and thereby for others, and start, you know, starting wherever I start. One measures a circle starting anywhere, and I started kind of with Whitley Strieb. I mean, that was definitely the beginning of a new phase for me in trying to find true coherence as opposed to this false second matrix coherence that I'd been reproducing through my books as Aeolus Cephas. But the fact, if it does, as you're saying, if introducing elements of that are more malevolent, more manipulative, more related to trauma, dissociation, and sexual abuse, and that they seem entirely incompatible with the narrative as it is, because they strip it of any of its glamour, right? They strip it of any appeal. If introducing those things, as with Strieber, makes the narrative more coherent, then it's actually showing that it was incomplete before and now it's more complete. Therefore, it's not so much necessary about these things have been weaponized, it's that they were always weapons to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think a couple of things that you do that are probably very unpopular. One that I just loved, I'm not exactly sure where you do it, where you made reference to psychedelics and you said, having done all these psychedelics, I don't feel I'm a better person in the least. That's my experience entirely. And I am a veteran of many, many psychedelic experiences, and they weren't the least bit edifying. And your further suggestion that maybe they're actually harmful, you know, I think that's going to go against the grain today, especially when, you know, I know a lot of people in that world, and they're, it's so interesting. They have all the enthusiasm about psychedelics that O'Leary had, well, ironically, O'Leary had in the 60s. You know, they still are acting as though this is going to revolutionize mental health. This is going to be, you know, the cutting edge into the future of human psychology. And then I think you taking Crowley at his word. I think that rubs a lot of people wrong. I think a lot of people just would rather him be this, you know, dark aesthete who says crazy things under the influence, but couldn't possibly mean any of that stuff. You know, it seems to be kind of where Gordon White would be. Because if you do take him at his word, then you really have opened the door to trauma, child abuse, and worse.
Well, again, like, what's the motive in these, in us, I should say, when we want to believe something? So we want to believe a narrative, a philosophy, a methodology, whatever. And therefore, we have to overlook the elements that suggest that it's maybe not benign. And so then that allows us to invest in it and practice it. And then, of course, we get more invested, right? Psychology, a previous investment. If you've done a lot of psychedelics, you're going to be a lot less willing to see the possibility that they might have not helped you. They might have done damage to your nervous system and so on. Not just because you want to keep on doing them either, but because it would be an unpleasant thing to have to accept and admit. And so then... one that would create a kind of internal dissembling, I think, where you're constantly covering up your own insights and your own, you're basically impairing your cognitive faculties, and not that they haven't already been impaired by trauma. And then I think things like occultism and psychedelics, I think in a way the way they work is that they impair our cognitive faculties. And I think that you can see that. I mean, you could say that they co-opt them, or they harness them, or they, you know, this is the thing, Kripal's thing and Strieber's thing is about breaking the mirror of expectations so that you can see other realms and so on, and these other realms are more real, and in actual fact, this realm is only made real by our own beliefs and our own, you know, sort of the narrow chinks of our cognitive faculties or our interpretation mechanism, like Huxley's reducing valve. We fixed reality into this thing. So if we mess with the machinery or the instrumentality of our own cognition, we'll free up our perception and we'll enter into a whole other realm. Well, So that's not a million miles away from just fuck up your cognitive faculties. How do you tell the difference, right? And I think you can't. I mean, I think I can see that in the arguments that somebody like Kripal, or certainly Strieber, I mean, you can hear it in his voice, or Lavender make. They're, because it's hard to tell if they're dishonest or they're just they're not thinking it through clearly because of this commitment to a certain belief.
Well, what, for myself personally, reading Prisoners of Infinity, what became really evident with me was, you know, I have a trauma history like everyone else. I started abusing drugs at age 11. I went for about 20 years. So I'm trying to get out of my head. I'm disembodied, right? I'm going into my head. But once I'm in my head through the trauma, I don't want to be in my head. So I try to get out of my head. Right? So it's further disembodiment. And then recovery comes around. And for many years in my recovery, it was endless spiritual seeking. It was one fad after another, one author after another, one practice after another. And only from reading your book could I see that that was even further flight from the body. Because a lot of it was extremely intellectual. I think arguably mindfulness can go in that direction as well. Eventually I would come back to the body through yoga and, have you ever heard of Robert Sardello?
No.
Yeah, he does some practices, contemplative practices with the heart. So eventually, and only then when I started coming back to my body, did a really serious reckoning with trauma happen. It was almost like I couldn't really even acknowledge the impact of trauma on the whole addiction cycle until I, at some degree, returned to my body. Otherwise, it was just full flight from the body. And you see this. And I think when you're that flight from the body because of trauma and into all these spiritual practices to heal yourself, another thing that's happening there is you're seeing massive spiritual commodification. Because you have to buy the next thing. You have to try the next practice. You're almost there. You've almost healed. You know, it's almost like Scientology or something where you're just going to spend endless amounts of money to go nowhere. And that feels very much like the spiritual marketplace today, especially in the States, I would say, where people appear to be, you know, desperately unhappy. Increasingly so, I should say.
I mean, I do yoga, but as I've said many times, I only do yoga for my physical health. I don't do it as a spiritual practice. I'm sure my yoga teacher would be was upset, you know, about that, or would be. But
would you say you do it as an embodiment practice?
I wouldn't say that, but I wouldn't deny it either. It definitely, I'm aware when I go to yoga, one of the things that's going on besides I'm, you know, finding out how inflexible I am and hopefully becoming a bit less inflexible, is that I have to experience a lot of psychological discomfort just by having my attention so much on my body and not being distracted by anything else. So sure, that's like Whitley's Gurdjieff and, you know, body meditation, where he spends 2 hours every day for the last 30 years putting his attention on his body, except that in Whitley's case, I don't know how much it's helped. And that's kind of what I was trying to get to, is that I don't trust spiritual practices at all anymore. And I think that, unless we're going to say breathing is a spiritual practice, or, you know, and so on and so forth, if somehow we make our ordinary way of being in our body and in the world can become a spiritual practice, but I think essential to that is we wouldn't really formalize it. We certainly wouldn't turn it into a teaching or what have you. We would just kind of notice it. Oh, this is helping me to become more embodied. But what I was thinking about while you're talking with the spiritual marketplace and it's an oxymoron, isn't it? A spiritual marketplace. The spirituality, I think, I mean, the concept of it has been imported from the East, really. And yet, as Jung wrote about, we're not really compatible with the kind of beliefs and practices that they have developed in the East, because it, you know, it's body, it comes out of the body and the culture, and you know, it's specific to a time and a place and a people and genetics and all those factors. And so I think what's happened, and this isn't to say that spirituality in the East hasn't been corrupted too, but I think in the West what's happened, and we could actually use Crowley as a flashpoint here, because Crowley was one of the main importers of yoga to the West, or at least a Crowley follower, anyway, I forget his name now, Arnold Bennett maybe. What was I going to say? Oh, that's in the process of being translated into the West, I think spirituality really has just become a lighter side of occultism. But essentially, in the West, we don't do passivity. We don't get with us a program that says you're just supposed to sit there and wait like Buddha and watch all your delusions come out, which would be equivalent to going into your body and feeling, you know, where the energy is blocked and eventually letting the trauma come into your awareness. You don't do anything. You just sit and wait, and what you're waiting for is the very thing you've spent your life trying to avoid. Well, no, there's no fun in that. There's no sense of power or purpose or direction. It's the opposite. It's a surrender path. And I don't think we do surrender in the West. And so I think, all of these practices and what we're talking about today maybe is that something has been, like, knowledge has been commodified and reconfigured in such a way that it's all about power, essentially, the will to power.
Right, I'm going to acquire these faculties by doing these practices, which will give me wealth and beauty and sex and all the rest.
Well, I mean, that's at the most crass level, for sure, but even that will give me wisdom, that will give me enlightenment, will help me to transcend the ego, you know. Well, in occultism, it's knowledge in conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel, or yeah, attunement to the planets, or there's any number of, you know, variables there. They seem like they're directed towards transcending and towards kind of higher spheres. But I think, as I wrote, as one of the central theses in Prisoner Infinity, I think that in this process of translating Eastern spirituality to Westernism, we've conflated, or we've mistaken, the spiritual realm, or the spiritual dimension of being, for the psychic. In other words, we've superimposed the quest for enlightenment on the quest for cities, which is the inverse.
Yeah, I remember you right. Yeah.
So it's all about getting cities, and we've convinced ourselves, or tricked ourselves, into believing there's no difference between cities that make you feel enlightened and actual enlightenment. And so then we've got all these narratives and testimonies about a pseudo enlightenment that's just about getting a bunch of cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got nothing. I mean, it's Chinese whispers. You get further and further away from the actual reality, while still referring back the terms of enlightenment and so on and all the rest of it. But it's a map that no longer even closely resembles the territory.
White beard sweeps the ground.
So when we're looking at all this trauma, the narrative around trauma that we're seems to be emerging around, you know, everything like Epstein and you know, the possibility of mind control and pay to play to move up the ranks. And then you look over to the alt-right and they're always putting an occult veneer on it, talking about the Luciferians or calling out the OTO. I guess Crowley gets named a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me it's always like, who's telling the story?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're getting kind of, the left really doesn't do much with it, but the far left does a little bit. You know, Whitney Webb will delve into Epstein and bring you back to, oh, Meyer Lansky and Roy Cohn. And then when you go over to the right, they start talking adrenochrome and Crowley and the OTO. Mm. What do you make of that? What do you make of the... On the one hand, you've got the right wants to say it goes all the way back to, you know, sinister occult practices going back into antiquity, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go more to the far left, it's much more reasonable. It's much less shocking. It's government agencies, you know, organized crime, corporations wielding power.
I guess you need to put them together, just like left and right. I mean, you can't have one without the other in any other system in creation. So how we imagine that somehow any sort of ideology could represent reality that was only half of the equation is part of that same internal dissembling, I think. And I mean, it's negative identity, isn't it? Like the problem, there's a problem there because the left wants to identify as left, and central to its identity is the existence of the right as the opposite of it. And so, anything that the right believes that if you're on the left, you have to reject it.
Right.
If you end up believing the same things as the enemy, then you become indistinguishable from them. So that's schismogenesis, isn't it? That's divide and conquer.
Yeah. There are a few people I found. Have you looked at Annika Lucas?
No.
I highly recommend that you look at Annika Lucas, A-N-N-E-K-A Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a TED Talk. She's a prominent yogi in the L.A. scene.
Right.
And she says that she was sexually trafficked by the Belgian elite. She's about my age. She's born in 63 and then went on this long, long journey of recovery. But when she talks about, she has a blog that goes with her videos. When she talks about what was done to her, it sounds exactly like some of the insinuations made on the right. So she's somebody who can kind of bridge the two.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses, you know, she really looks at this as an addiction through the lens of addiction, but an addiction to power.
Mm-hmm.
Also the violation of taboo is a way of empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I have to read Vice of Kings now.
That's certainly more about taboo than Prison Infinity, and my current book as well. I keep coming back to taboo, and it's the way that it's employed for social control. And I haven't fully, you know, I'm not able to articulate it easily because it's, I think it's such a profound and ancient mechanism or device for managing society that it's quite hard to unpack it, you know, because it's...
Well, I think Girard is very interesting here because he's saying that
taboo in religion exists to protect the community from violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually when the taboo is violated, that sameness, the loss of differentiation is what creates the violence.
The mimesis, the mimetic violence.
Yes. Yeah. It unleashes the mimetic. And so when the Bloods and the Crips basically look identical, they just have different colored bandanas.
Mm-hmm.
But I find this very interesting because on the one hand, you have certain rituals in indigenous cultures where one of the things that's really distinctive about them is there's a loss of social identity. For a period of time, you know, there's not a chief and a warrior and a elder. Everyone in this ritual setting, there's a loss of identity, which seems to make certain kinds of, for lack of a better term, spiritual things happen. Whereas Girard seems to be suggesting, well, they both would say that the loss of that identity, the loss of that distinction, is what really makes violence, you know, the mass, the group contagion happen. So there seems to be some strange parallel where, I mean, Victor and Edith Turner were the ones who noticed that there's a loss of social identity in certain kinds of ritual behaviors. And they're clear that that's dangerous.
Mm.
That can only happen on prescribed times and spaces. It cannot be, maybe they do it in prescribed times to prevent it from spreading out.
Contain it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and also because this liminality is the anti-structure, isn't it? So it's that structures, if they're maintained too long, they become imprisoning, and then that's a different kind of violence, or it means there's no violence, but there's also no life. You know, people can't even flourish within that. I'm not exactly sure. Like, we'd have to look at our own society in terms of, you know, when there's an excess of control and structure, that might reduce the chaos and therefore the violence, but
but that energy has to erupt elsewhere. It's too contained, or
I think it, in the long run it increases it, yeah, because if you're too repressed, if you're too confined, if you're oppressed, eventually there's some kind of uprising. And of course, the ruling classes, that they do, they want to avoid revolution whenever they can, and when they can't, they want to make sure they create their own revolutions. So that would be, you know, manufactured periods of liminality and social collapse, whether it's the economy or whatever else. But yeah, it does seem as though there isn't of necessity there. Our periods of disruption are needed, and even you could even say to inject new life into the system, it has to keep transmuting itself.
But of course, Girard is also saying that the scapegoat mechanisms aren't really working anymore either,
mm-hmm.
which is requiring that the you know, that the burnt sacrifices are becoming more and more bloody. Yeah, that's another thing that your work did, is it took me back into my Girard notes, which was quite interesting.
Hmm. So I wanted to talk about addiction a bit, because I think it's a big subject. What were you addicted to?
In the end, I was addicted to heroin for the last 2 years. Prior to that, as much involvement with marijuana and alcohol as anything.
Mm.
But I'm no stranger to smoking coke and crystal meth and lots of hallucinogens, although I don't believe that they're properly addictive. Go on, I'm sorry.
And this is very personal. For personal reasons, I'm asking, what year were you born?
1963.
Okay, I know, because you mentioned that, so I wasn't. So, because my brother was born in 1962, and he, as you may or may not have picked up, he died of a heroin overdose.
Yeah.
Also my brother-in-law. And one of the things I get into in Vice of Kings, I mean, Crowley, of course, died a heroin addict. He didn't die of heroin addiction, but he was an addict when he died. But he was also a cocaine addict during that critical period in the Abbey of Thelema, where I suspect he was conducting child sex rituals of some kind, if not, you know, worse.
A child died mysteriously, didn't it?
At least one child died during that period, yeah. And, yeah, so when I looked into his cocaine use, or how central it was into his magical diaries, he was even giving the children cocaine, and talking very small children, baby even, giving a baby cocaine. And also looking into the known effects of cocaine, which is an interesting subject in and of itself, because cocaine psychosis was what was known about in the time that Freud was using it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in the 70s, they were saying cocaine was harmless, right? So how do you square that circle, right? Anyway, obviously we know it's not harmless now, but not only is it not harmless, it's incredibly harmful. And the kind of... the way, as you were saying about speed, well, it's exactly what you're talking about, intimacy without vulnerability. It allows, I think it allows a kind of psychic possession by which, this is what I observed with Crowley, I think he was using it as a magical aid towards possession, archetypal possession, if you like, but possession by his own unconscious, maybe would be another way of putting it, so that he was able to commit these incredibly transgressive acts.
Mm-hmm.
In a magical context, and thereby transcend his social identity. Anyway, I mean, I'm not quite sure I was going here, but this whole question, I mean, it occurred to me while I was researching and writing that, how much my own mindset, even though I'm born into a family of drug addicts and all the rest of it, was somehow that drugs, not that they're harmless or anything like that, but that they're not that important in some way. That they're just these products, these chemicals, these plants that have been abused, and that's about it, really. Like, they never seem like that important a subject. But researching Crowley and how central that was to his philosophy and his behavior and all the rest of it, and then later reading Douglas Valentine and the CIA's organized crime, how central cocaine was to that criminal, is to that criminal underworld. Not just for profit, but for social destabilization, introducing whole populations to cocaine, and the overlap with the CIA is with death cults, the cartels, again occult ritual, kind of the worst, the darkest sort. Seems to me more and more that drugs and drug addiction really is central to the way in which. Humanity has been traumatized and compromised and disconnected from its life force.
Well, I think you're all over it. You live in British Columbia, right?
Yeah.
Do you know who Bruce Alexander is?
I don't.
He's a neighbor of yours. He's the founder of something called the dislocation theory of addiction.
Yeah.
And he did the Rat Park experiments way back in the day. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah, so he's a friend of mine.
Oh.
And he shows historically how modern addiction, meaning widespread across certain socioeconomic, ethnic groups, really happens at a point in time, like I said earlier, it was really in Britain. And that he calls this due to dislocation. So he believes that when you're, I mean, biologically, your body produces dopamine from being happy, from playing with your dog. Sexual arousal, smelling good food. We produce dopamine all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We also produce endorphins all the time when we feel secure and loved and connected. And so he's saying that we will turn to these substances in environments of extreme dislocation. So when you have a group of people that are, you know, really dislocated, like African Americans in South Central LA,
mm-hmm.
and you dump so much cocaine on the market that the price of cocaine goes, you know, from $2,000 an ounce down to a couple hundred, now anybody can pipe up. It's almost irresistible. You know, same for booze and in the first industrial cities in England and so on and so forth. Native Americans down here with booze. The more dislocated they are, the more they fear for their children's future, the more the drugs become a panacea.
Right.
But what you're talking, what you started with, I couldn't agree with more. So I've had many clients, for instance, middle-aged men who the dynamic of their drug addiction is really smoking crack and going to prostitutes.
Hmm.
And one does not happen without the other.
That's what my brother did.
Yeah, it's really hard. That's really, really, really compelling. And so the reward circuitry just becomes kind of the default mode. You get depressed, you do that. You get anxious, you do that. You get bored, you do that. But that shallowing of the emotions, the de-eroticization, really makes things kinkier and kinkier and kinkier. So, you know, porn addiction progresses not by the volume you consume, but by how bizarre the pornography becomes.
Right.
So we have these young boys now who can't even get aroused by conventional sexuality. You add speed or cocaine to that, and, you know, the dogs are just going to run wild. And I think somebody like Crowley, who kind of knew that what little conscience he had may put the brakes on normally, if he imbibed the cocaine, he can do things. There's complete, the ego has no inhibitions. So I think that's why it's so common in the world of prostitution, stripping, human trafficking, and often the sex workers will also use the opiates to you know, forget the pain of what they just did. Yeah, I think it's a totally, totally sophisticated form of mind control. The fact that these Mexican cartels too are getting into these ritualized behaviors that are sort of part of the business of drug dealing, right? Mm-hmm. You sacrifice bodies to placate, you know, what's her name? La Muerta, Santa Muerta, the saint of death. Yeah, so you're really looking at something like an artificially induced psychopathy, meaning what empathy and compassion you have is knocked out of commission by the drug, and then you're pretty much free to act out. Addicts, when they get sober, they're part of the problem of being sober is where our conscience wakes up and it accuses us. And so,
right.
And for most of us, the only thing we can do to quiet our conscience is to do more drugs.
interesting because I've never been an addict in quotes, you know, I never had a particular substance addiction. The closest I've come would be marijuana or hash in England. And one of the things I noticed about my smoking habit was that it put my body to sleep. And so after I smoked, although I'd have a kind of hangover in the morning, I'd feel pleasantly numb, comfortably numb. But after a couple of days, I'd start to feel really shitty. So in the days where I was smoking regularly, I would notice I would feel fine as long as I was smoking. And after I stopped smoking for a day or two, but then after a couple more days, all these symptoms would start coming up.
And what kind of symptoms are you talking about?
Might be catching cold, might just be headaches. And I mean, I had chronic fatigue syndrome for 20 years, so I always had symptoms, and sometimes smoking pot would make them worse. But I would find, you know, if I could kind of find the right moment to get high, then I would neutralize the symptoms. And then if I stayed high, I'm not saying I did this as conscious practice, I'm saying I observed it over time that I was doing it, then I could minimize the symptoms, and I could also even avoid getting sick much, right? But then as soon as I stopped for a period, I would get sick, usually a cold, let's say, and then my standard symptoms would come back.
Did you notice anything emotionally when you were not smoking?
Well, one of the reasons I would smoke was if I started feeling melancholy. I know that there was definitely a correlation between, oh, I'm feeling sad, I want to get high.
Did you get high with people?
Yeah, I mean, I did both. Towards the, you know, last 10 years of my smoking, most of it was solitary and, you know, very occasional. But when I was smoking more regularly, it was both. It was a social thing and a solitary shamanic thing. Like I'd do all my things when I was high, right? Yeah.
So you feel it's safe to say that there is a certain disembodiment?
Definitely that. It was disembodying, and that correlated with how much more intense my thoughts became, as in, as you know, when you smoke pot, everything seems incredibly meaningful. I'm having these amazing insights, and so on and so forth. Another, I mean, the thing about the psychedelics, I'd say about weed as well. Like, for all of the meaning and the purpose and the intensity it provided at the time, looking back, very little, if any, of that was meaningful or useful. It just, you know, it was
Yeah,
kind
I
of.
sometimes speculate, I don't know, I'm going to run with this someday maybe, that whether one becomes an addict has much to do with why they use drugs. But then again, you seem like somebody with a trauma history. You know, so if you look at, you know, there's a famous study that compares alcohol consumption amongst the French and the Italians. Per capita, it's roughly the same. And yet rates of alcoholism are much higher with the French. And sociologists thinks because drinking with the Italians is, you know, social, circumscribed around food and family and conviviality and all that. This more solo drinking, solo using to, you know, to regulate my affect. But I mean, I think in light of Prisoner of Infinity, when you have, you see, another thing Bruce Alexander would say is that trauma is not necessarily sexual assault or combat. He could say trauma is sustained stress, living in the stress response day after day, which at least in the States, you know, most people do. So we're always, yeah, and so, you know, I think the funny thing about trauma is you get disembodied in the traumatic experience. But the interesting thing about being a drug addict or even a drug abuser is you're deliberately disembodying yourself for relief. So there's, you know, that thing about what's the word they use? reenacting the trauma. Is that right?
Reenacting the trauma. Yeah, because there's two things going on with drug use, particularly if it's heroin. If you're shooting up, like my brother said, that one of the reasons he carried on using heroin was because he just loved the ritual, and he used that term of injecting himself, and that's obviously very body focused. You really have to focus on the body, and you're actually harming the body physically, and so that would make you very aware of the body preceding the disembodiment of the high and even the ritual.
Yes.
You know, one of the reasons I smoke pot a lot, I always mixed it with tobacco. I just really enjoyed the act of smoking the joint much more than I would have enjoyed a cigarette. So it was a combination. I'm going to have a brief, intense experience of my physicality, as in the discomfort of smoking and the harshness on the throat and all the rest of it, and the ritual of making the cigarette, and followed by this super high. And one thing I noticed might be relevant here is whenever I was going to smoke, I would, well, two things might happen. One was my symptoms would start coming up and I'd realize I couldn't smoke. I'd decide to, but then all of these body pains would come and I was like, fuck it, I can't, because they would include a sore throat. Another thing would happen was if I really was going to smoke and it was going to happen, I would need to take a shit right beforehand. I'd suddenly have a really, you know, my bowels become incredibly loose. And then the third thing that seems relevant
is... That's totally common with cocaine.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Prior?
Yes, when you see the drug dealer show up, your bowels just release.
Yeah. Oh. Wow. So, and then the other thing I was going to mention is I noticed always my body temperature would go down after I smoked pot. I always became cold.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like the body warmth. The warmth ether, Steiner would say, leaves the extremities and probably goes towards the head.
I just thought of a possibly random correlation, but they say that when there's entities, the room temperature goes down.
Yeah.
In the paranormal field, right? That's one of the tells that there's an entity present. It's a drop in temperature. And that's how I experienced it. It was just like the temperature in the room went down.
I do think we're kind of dancing around, you know, there's the dynamic where the same forces that are profiting off of human trafficking are obviously profiting off of selling drugs.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
down here, you know, what we do is we treat drug addiction with drugs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a two-horned beast, meaning on the one side you've got licit drugs, and with the opioid epidemic, these were non-drug abusing people going to get medical treatment and just being compliant. They were simply being compliant, and they wound up strung out on Oxycontin, and they were usually white people who had insurance. And then on the other hand, you have the illicit drugs, which is, you know, not Adderall and Oxycontin, it's crystal meth and heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Structurally not that much different. But what we do is we lock those people up, and the prison industrial complex makes money off of them, but they have black and brown skin. So it's really, yeah, it's social control writ large.
Yeah, well, I've seen that. I mean, if you think the extent that, and this is what I wanted to get to, what is addiction? I think one way I've tried to reframe it is voluntary possession. And if you think about drugs as a chemical kind of possession, like whatever is in those plants that makes us high, alters our consciousness, is some kind of living, you know? If you use the substance and you, it's almost like you microchip an eel or something and then you always know where it is. If you know the way that a substance affects consciousness, and then you can use it to map human behavior, because if you possess people with that drug, if you addict them to it and you possess their consciousness with the qualities of that drug, you can then anticipate the way that they will behave.
Well, didn't you see that strongly in Tom O'Neill with...
I was just going to say, yeah, because they were researching speed. Does speed make people violent? Well,
yeah.
Yeah. That clearly, that experiment has gone, operational.
There's a Native American activist named Eduardo Duran, and he says that in traditional cultures, you recognize that the plant is a spirit being. Mm. And so if you go to the plant for healing, you have to make some kind of offering, some kind of exchange. You have to make yourself worthy of the plant, something along those lines. And he says, if Westerners go to the same spirit beings, but they go for shits and giggles, and the plant, though, is still going to collect, the spirit being is still going to collect the debt.
Right.
And he says that's what addiction is. It's like a soul possession.
Who is this?
His name is Eduardo Duran. He does work with multi-generational trauma. He's half Native American.
Well, that was definitely my experience coming off psychedelics, as I've written about, that I had back taxes to pay. A whole shitload of them. And they were physical.
Are you speaking literally?
Well, they were physical. They were literal in the sense that physically I felt I had to detoxify a lot. But they were also psychological and emotional. In terms of it took a long time to readjust to reality. I had to let go of an awful lot of delusions that had been fed by those psychedelics.
Were you engaging in occult practices at the same time?
As the psychedelics, yes.
Yeah.
This is the short answer, yes. Yeah. I was in Guatemala, so I had a Mashimon deity, or an effigy of Mashimon, who's like the dark god of the Mayans. And I was doing rituals, even healing rituals with other people. And I was full hog.
What were you doing for plants?
Salvia divinorum was the main one.
I'm surrounded by people in my own immediate circle who leave ayahuasca ceremonies, and they don't leave alone, and they bring things home with them, and then they have to go through pretty strenuous ordeals to get rid of these entities. Not uncommon at all.
Right. Well, that's worth testifying to, because I don't think there's much awareness about that particular risk.
No, there's this sort of strange idealization of ayahuasca, like it's totally benign. Mm-hmm. My experience is anything but. It's I don't know what to make of it. Formidable as hell. And I also think we turned the shaman into some sort of noble figure, and many of them are brujos. They're all about power, just like other humans.
Yeah.
Power and advantage, and so
I stopped talking now because I felt like I had a very profound insight, but I kind of lost it. But it has to do with, I know what it was. I was talking to Alison Miller recently about the satanic ritual abuse, organized ritual abuse, and how one of the ways that works is they create a theater of dissociation, a theater of abuse that co-opts the dissociative faculty by implanting imagery into psyche while it's dissociating. As compared to, like, if we're traumatized, we're going to dissociate, and maybe we'll generate our own fantasy, or maybe we'll even connect to some transcendental reality. I'm not ruling out Kripal's thesis there entirely. There is an element there. So if you co-opt that and you use it for programming mind control, part of that is you create theaters by which, rather than the psyche finding its own dissociative imagery, you give the psyche the imagery, right?
Screen memories is...
Well, it's part, part of, that's right, part of it is screen memories, but it's also you're creating an identity, because you're informing the way in which it interprets reality. So if you're doing it to children. But the reason I brought it up was because it just occurred to me that psychedelics might be similar, because essentially, the way I understand it, psychedelics hack into the unconscious. mm-hmm. and they give us access to the unconscious. This is very related to liminality as well, like those rituals. It's about suspend the structures, the social identities, for a period so that the chaos can emerge and we can renew ourselves and so on, and we can discover more about who we are, you know, beneath those structures. And it's necessary and you know, healthful to do it in the right context. So the way I understood at a certain point psychedelics, and how I understood the backtaxing thing, was that I was hacking into my own unconscious and releasing all of this energy and all of this material, but in such a way that it was almost impossible to really process it, right? Apply it. And so that was the backtaxes. Basically, I have to process for years afterwards these experiences that only took an hour or so, right?
But which just they like to politely call integration.
Who calls it that?
Well, all the psychedelic shamans, they say, oh, that's just integration.
Over the years.
Yeah, not supposed you've had to such take an years. Intense experience that it takes years to integrate.
Yeah.
But I think back taxes is much, yes.
Well, it's, go ahead. I mean, it's not the wrong term, but I think, like anything else, there's a realistic way of approaching it. And if you're taking years to integrate an experience that only lasted 3 hours, then something is off there, right? Surely. And I think maybe this does relate to this insight I've had, is that inseparable from the way that the plants give us unnatural or turbo-boosted access to our unconscious is the fact that they are also informing our experience of the unconscious. So, you know, whatever comes up, that imagery and those insights and all the rest of it, I don't think it's not only coming from our unconscious, is it? It's actually being put in there.
Yes. And that's this big thing with ayahuasca. Why does somebody drinking ayahuasca in Tel Aviv see anacondas and pink river dolphins and hummingbirds, just like somebody in London does? Yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Right. So that's like inception. That's possession.
Yeah.
Potentially. You're getting a download, and the download stays in you, particularly if you're attached to the vision and you feel it's helped you find yourself.
What did you call it earlier in the conversation? You said...
voluntary possession.
Voluntary. Yes.
Yeah,
that's right. I'm going to work with that for a while.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time.
That's the end of my conversation with Piers. Next week's podcast, which will be the first of 2020, is with Brian Hayden, the author of The Power of Ritual in Prehistory, about secret societies and aggrandizer culture. That's it. I wish you all a very happy new year as the 2020 vision descends upon us all. And I'd like to thank all the donators, listeners, readers, and participants in this podcast and other Wise Horticultural Experiment project over the last year. Your presence and participation is much appreciated, and in fact the ears that make sure that there is a sound in this particular forest. So thanks again, and until 2020, this is the podcast between.
Change with the night, strangers in the heart, stay up until light, dangers in your soul, they motion to the stars, changes in the heart, change with the